Today's guest on the Mechanics Gallon is Peter Burns, who has been involved in motorsport for, well, he tells me, over 40 years, including 15 years with McLaren in their heyday of the Marlboro McLaren cars. Peter, welcome.
I'm good. It's a brisk, cold morning here in down near the coast in England.
Well, it's actually, it's quite cloudy here today. It's only about 70.
It's about, if it was pushing seven, it would be doing quite well here.
I know. There you go. So you sent me the other day a little list of your career, and we start in 1981 with the Dubai Grand Prix, and you're at the Motorsport Festival. So how did you get that job, Peter, and what were you doing?
Well, it's a long story, but we've got plenty of time. I graduated with a law degree, decided I didn't want to go and become a lawyer. And I went and worked for a company called Cable and Wireless, which used to do the international telecommunications. And I was with them for 3 years. And our first, I suppose, semi-professional involvement with motorsport was organising a charity for a friend of mine. He was a young up-and-coming racing driver called Roger Pedrick. This is back in 1977. He was going to drive one of the Hawk Formula Ford cars, and he was testing at Brands Hatch. He went off Paddock Hill Bend. The long story is, and he broke his neck, and he became paralysed. And there was a group of us, because we all used to drink together on a Friday night in Tunbridge Wells. And me and a friend of mine, Ian Dickens, who went on to become the marketing director at Olympus, we had these bright ideas because we wanted to raise some money for Roger so he could have a vehicle to be driven around in. And as the evening wore on, of course, the number of the alcohol consumption got more, and we came up with this bright idea that why don't we get a hospital bed and push it from the Houses of Parliament to Queen Mary's Hospital in Sidcup. The following morning, we woke up and think, did we really say we were going to do this? And the momentum continued, and there were 16 of us doing in four shifts of four, and we literally pushed this hospital bed all the way from the Houses of Parliament, flagged off by Mark Thatcher, no less, who was friends with a lady from Silverstone who was the press officer, and we were doing stuff with them. And we raised £14,000. For him, it was quite good. That led on to doing a couple of fundraising activities for Roger. And at that stage, where I was in Cable and Wireless, and I'd lived overseas for a short period in Oman. And they were doing it was for the PDO, which was the Shell, the local Shell company, effectively, and putting in a new microwave system for the North and South. I quite liked the idea of going out there and living abroad, and I got the buzz for living overseas. And a little bit later, I was on a business trip to Abu Dhabi, and they have these magazines that they shove under the door to give you what's going on. And there was a picture there of a Don Revy, who you might remember was the Leeds English manager, who was working on various projects out in Dubai with the Sheikh. And they'd come up with the idea that they were going to do what they called the Dubai Grand Prix. I don't know if you might remember, there was the Birmingham on the Streets. They used to have the festival that started off as a festival and then became a race. Well, the guy that was originally behind it was a chap called Martin Hone, who...
That's right, yeah. Yes.
Well, Martin had talked his way in. He was a very convincing talker, very eloquent. And he got the contract to organise a race in the Dubai Grand Prix. Now, I call it a Dubai Grand Prix. It wasn't a proper Grand Prix. It was an festival race. But we had the purest kind. We had two Formula One cars, a Theodore with Patrick Tombay and the McLaren with John Watson. There was a round of the Touring Car Championships, which I think Tom Walkinshaw won. They had historic Aston Martins and the historic sports cars and whatever. And I, excuse me, I got involved by pestering Martin Hone to say, I'd like to give up my three-year-old job to work on a three-month-old project. And I pestered him, and eventually I got the job. And we went out, and literally we put this event together in with the 3 months. And it was in those days, because the bits of Dubai, were, a lot of it was reclaimed land. And they had the Hyatt Regency Hotel was put on it. And there were some roads and some areas for a track. They literally built the track that linked together the various roads on this reclaimed land. So years later, I went and worked in Dubai for the circuit years later. And it, we went to try and find the circuit, and it sort of got lost because of the number of buildings. But in those days, it was all reclaimed. It was a pretty amazing event. All sorts of things. We had James Hunt was there, Jody Scheckter, Patrick Tombay, wide variety. Fangio was there. In fact, Fangio had a heart attack and had to take him back to hospital. There was also one of the Porsche, there was a German Can-Am style series. And there was one that the German owner decided he needed to, he didn't want the car to be transported by road from the airport to the circuit. So they hooked it up with a helicopter. So they had the helicopter holding up this Porsche as it went along, which then they discovered that the roll bar strength was maybe not quite what they thought they would, and it fell a little bit as it was. But it was a baptism of fire, and I think that's when I learned pressure. I never had pressure as strong as that. But it was a fantastic event, and I was a youngster in those days, and it was good. Coming out of that, I wanted to go, and I didn't want to go back to my job in London. I decided to go, and I took basically a year off, and went and lived in Australia. I had all grand ideas, living in Australia and working for an advertising agency. And after a while, the money started to run out. So I ended up working in a Cadbury's chocolate factory, making all sorts of chocolates. There you learn that certain of the products is really, what they have the bits left over, it goes into the fudge and stuff like that. But they had the policy that you could eat anything on the production line, providing you didn't take it home with you, which sounds exotic. The fact is that if you've got the freedom for about 3 weeks, you don't want any chocolate. You've had enough of it. So it was good.
How long were you at the chocolate place then?
I was there about 5 months, I think, in Ringwood, just outside of Melbourne. But I had to keep going because I had to pay for my fare to come back. And the reason it was I was on one of these, I think, what is it, a holiday work visa as such, and it expired once you got to 25. So I that's what the reason why I did that. So I worked there. I then travelled around Australia. I had one of those bus passes, you know, those 21-day bus passes, and I spent the equivalent of 13 and a half days on this coach travelling around Australia. So starting from Perth to go back to Adelaide, up to Alice Springs, Darwin, and then around. So I it was good. I hate going on coaches now because I think I had too many times on doing that then. Then went to America and spent some time there, and I was there in time for the Long Beach Grand Prix, which was a pretty spectacular event. So that was really good. Yeah, 83. When I left on the 25th of April, 1982, and arrived back in Gatwick exactly 1 year later on the 25th of April, 1983. So I decided that I wanted to stay involved in motorsport and different activities. And like anything, there's a great statistic that 60% of people are doing basically what they don't want to do. And that always a bit, if you, once you've been exposed to the fact and you want to get involved and you can make a living out of motorsport, it's a preferable way to go. So I worked, I was looking for a job in London. I went to work for a PR company called Sports Action, which is based in central London, off Piccadilly. And we worked with companies like Nikon, with Centurion crash helmets, and a few others. Oh, Yokohama tires, I think, was another one, which was great. And then one day, you look at the back of Autosport and you see there's this job for an account handler for working for McLaren.
I think we've all looked in the back of all those sports jobs, Peter. Yeah, so you saw something at McLaren.
Yeah, I saw that, and much to my amazement, I thought, well, I'll apply. We're not going to get it because there's going to be hundreds of people applying for it, whatever. So I booked one. And actually, it was around about February because I think I just got engaged. It was what was it called? 14th of February, if you're is what is it? Valentine's Day. That's it. Anyway, I'd fallen on some ice and broke my wrist or something like that. So my newly found fiance actually typed up my CV and I sent it in with a covering letter, doing it one weekend in the Sports Action offices. And I thought nothing more of it, to be honest. And then, much to my surprise, I got a message that what they'd like to interview me, which I thought, well, that's something. And then my interview was with Ron Dennis.
Right. Now, where was this, Peter? Was it still at Colnbrook, or were they? It would
No,
have been,
this
wouldn't
was at that stage. It was at Boundary Road, and
Ah,
in
yeah. Okay.
Woking.
Yeah.
There's some smallish facilities. I mean, I think there are about 80 to 90 people who actually
Yeah.
work for McLaren these days.
Right.
Yeah, with Ron Dennis, and I was. It must have been in his office about 40 minutes or so, which sounds very interesting, but the reality is I was speaking to him for about 10 to 15 minutes because he's the pace. He just kept the telephones kept going and his deals. And I couldn't help but pinch myself, the fact that here I was, and you've been reading about all these sort of people and suddenly you're there. It was very positive. And I always remember he had this great big oak, sort of a brownie oak desk that was absolutely immaculate with just about a few pieces of paper on it. And the always thing that was impressive about Ron was just the pace. He'd start in the office and he'd just go, 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 go the whole time. I then went and had another interview, I think. And then I got the call from Bob Ehrman, who was the financial director, and said, yes, we'd like to offer you the job. And I could have fallen off. Absolutely staggered. I got actually finally got there, but I the weird thing was, I almost knew I was going to get it. It's that sort of feeling about it. So as I joined in May 1985. Excuse me, I just in a lubricate minute.
Yes, carry on. Join the club.
Your influence of having a drink now. So I joined McLaren and expecting all exciting sort of activities and getting involved in Formula One. And didn't quite work like that. For about the first 3 weeks, everything I said, whether it was taxes, faxes, remember faxes that threw in the machine? Taxes, whatever, any communication had to be approved by Ron. So it was. That control that it filled. The other interesting thing was, as soon as I'd got past that stage, the amount of responsibility suddenly had the floodgates open, and they were doing things. But my very first job was putting together a sponsorship proposal for a horse eventing. Now that was Sid Watkins' daughter, oldest daughter, Jessica. She now I think she flies, or she did certainly fly for Virgin as one of the flight crew. And she was wearing a whole She was a budding eventer, I think, for want of a better word. And we put together this proposal. The idea was there was a script, there was the equipment, how she had to put it together, and what she had to go and do and talk to the right sort of people. And we decided to do some films, some photographs to give it a colour, whatever. And she was riding on a horse, and then she fell off. She hit her head. And she seemed fine. And then we got going, and she'd be talking, and then suddenly you'd be talking, recounting the same conversation about 15 minutes later. And this kept reoccurring. So, oh Christ, this is problems. Well, it just so happened that her father, Sid, happened to be one of the Britain's, if not the world's, one of the top neurosurgeons. So we bundled her off and took her to the hospital that was up down in the East End in White. I think it's Whitechapel area. And I remember the first thing with Sid, we'd just brought her in, and he was walking down, and he had his gown on and his hat on, his Wellington boots, which were all part of what they used to wear. And said, and he had a big cigar in his mouth. And the first thing's, hello, darling. Had a bit of a shunt, but she luckily she replied, recovered completely after that. But that was my last induction. Another one was we were in Boundary Road, and we were going to be moving to a new facility, Albert Drive, which was about a mile or so further down the road, but much bigger. So it was from about 20,000 square foot to 67,000 square foot, I think. And my next job was to scout and find furniture. I mean, the whole of the interior, so the panelling and all that sort of thing. So I would did a tour of various places in London, whittled it down to three manufacturers, and then I introduced them to Ron. And I remember Ron rather typical way of operating. He said, "Right, got the guys down, and they were rubbing their hands with glee to see." You think, yeah, so you've got to deal with a Formula One team. I said, "Yeah, what I'm going to do is." I'll buy it from the UK manufacturer, but I want the German company, because it was a German company called Voco, which was based out in Germany, to sponsor the team. You know, the jaw dropped with the guy. But he realized he was going to get the sale, but they were going to supplement. And what we put together was basically a selected Grand Prix. They were going to take about 80 guests. The first adventure we actually had with them is that we had two groups, so the international and the British group. So the international stayed in one of the hotels in London, and the British group went to Leeds Castle, where I knew the venue there, because Ron was either getting married or just about to get married to Leeds Castle, where he had his reception. So we had them all flying in. There was just a huge number of volume of people. And that's when we first realized the full potential of doing hospitality. In 2 years later, they all decided that they liked the idea of the British Grand Prix, but they wanted to go and do Monaco. And they go, oh, God, how the hell are we going to solve that? Because there are about 80-odd people who are going to be doing this. And so the solution, and this again shows where I think McLaren led the way in terms of entrepreneurship and different ways of looking at the problem. We chartered Sea Goddess. Now, Sea Goddess is the 56 berth luxury yacht, which in 1988 was £250,000 to hire for the week for the week basically. And so we had it at a hotel, a floating hotel in Monaco, and then we did functions with it. But of course, what made it more complicated was the fact as you were going on to a boat, so you had to take your passport because you hadn't actually officially coming into. And we did very various promotions. One of which was this Hugo Boss brought this. This pianist called Eustace France, along, and the whole idea was he was going to play on the deck. Well, the women we'd approached them and said, "Well, can we put the Steinway on the deck?" Yeah, no problem. Of course, when you get to the actual event side, it suddenly did become a problem because he couldn't do it. So we then go into this long conversation, and the whole weekend is dominated by how are we going to get this bloody piano up so he could play on the deck. With the point, this again, this is a wrong way of saying it. Well, I bet you I could find a way. So I bet you $1,000 I'll get it done. And we had visions then of a helicopter floating over Monaco Harbour with a Steinway hanging at the bottom of it. I do remember it's one of the few times I said to him, "Ron, you probably could do, but I think we've got bit things are a bit more important to do that sort of thing." But then the pianist then decided to do an impromptu piano recital out on where the Steinway was originally outside of the restaurant. But I mean, this was 24/7 with the boat, and then we gave them hats, we gave them jackets, we gave them shoes, we gave them uniforms. They got model cars. I mean, they went everything, and it became 24 hours online, and so people were coming and going, and you just wanted to have. Relax afterwards because it really was 24/7. No, that's no, 8:25, I think, is a better way of describing it.
I mean, we know what Monaco's like. So for someone like you in that situation, that must have been absolutely manic.
It was. I think Mike Earl was one of the guests, and he kept saying, "I don't know how you keep going, like the power-driven bunny or such." And we finally got rid of them. We finally got them off the boat, into the coach, whatever. Only to find that once they're on the coach, the dustbin van was in the way, and they had to stop for about another 20 minutes. But the great thing was finally, because we had it out for a whole week. And there was a day or so left. We actually got the boat out, so there was 12 of us on board this boat, and we sailed down to Saint-Tropez.
Oh,
And I
nice.
caught a bit of sleep, and I just have this memory of sitting in the jacuzzi, looking across at Cannes with a glass of champagne, thinking, "Christ,
Lovely.
we've done this."
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Sorry, the one little anecdote I do remember was while we were chatting around London with Ron, trying to finding the various places. Ron being Ron, had decided he wanted to have a meeting, and he said, "Right, well, you can take my car, and I'm going to get a cab, and I'll meet you at James Hunt's place." Right. So, A, Ron's considerably taller than I was, and it was one of these Mercedes SL 520s or 580s or whatever it was, and the pedals were too far away because you could adjust the pedals and the steering wheel, and I spent ages, and I wondered why it was getting hotter and hotter, and maybe it was I was panicking because I didn't want to. The last thing I want to do is scratch the boss's car as we went round Hyde Park. Then I realised I wasn't pressing the button for to move the seat forward. I was actually pressing the button for the heated seat.
God, and the temperature's going up.
Well, it certainly felt like that.
Oh, I bet.
But going back to the James's house, where in those days, he must have, a lot of his money had disappeared. So he had this little A35 van, which was up on bricks at his place, whatever. But good old James, it always was good, great company.
Now, it was a place in Wimbledon, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Off the main road going into Wimbledon, whatever. So we got all the furniture sorted out, and then we moved into the new facility. And we used to have some pretty exotic parties. The McLaren parties were always very good. I mean, the first one I think I got involved in was near Gatwick. There was a big cylindrical room where they put all the people, and they brought an elephant in with Alain Prost on it.
Good God. Where did they get that from?
Oh, we had contacts.
Whipsnade or somewhere.
It's something like that, isn't it? What are we doing here? And it was all done with strict security, but there was one particular journalist, or I won't mention his name, who leaked it because one of the daft ideas we had is that they would do a spoof interview. And it was with Willis. And I'm not going to mention names because I better not. But there was a certain racing driver that was also with McLaren. And we had, no, what later became McLaren, he was a Marlboro driver with Ferrari at that particular time, who wasn't blessed with the greatest sense of humours. But we had this joke about we invited on a special guest to be introduced to one of the acts, and we brought on a monkey dressed up as a man. But the driver involved heard about this. He wasn't at the party because he wasn't with McLaren and such, and it nearly caused a bit of a diplomatic incident because he refused to drive for Marlborough for a short period of time and an official apology. And then we had to apologise to the monkey for impersonating the driver.
That's right. He was all right with it.
Yeah, that's true. Losing a strand now. Where were we?
Well, I've got up to 85 where you drive McLaren in time for the British Grand Prix.
Oh, that's right. Now that was one of those pinch me moments when, my first Grand Prix, I was in my pristine red trousers and white uniform, and all of that. And it was raining hard, and with the rain coming down, the helicopter couldn't take off. So with that, it wouldn't couldn't take off. Then practice was qualified. So I think it was on the Friday, and there I was, the new young call. And then there was Alain Prost, who was drinking his very strong coffee. There was Niki Lauda, who was on his he had his strawberries and yogurt. There was James Hunt, and there was Jackie Stewart, and they're all talking. And there's little old me in there, and I the jaw-dropping times to actually become involved with them. But then the amazing thing is that you get to know these guys a bit better, and you have to start working with them, and it's different.
What am I think I wanted to ask you, Peter, when you got involved with Tag Heuer, what was your job at McLaren? Was it sort of advertising manager or what would you call it?
Intellect executive gopher, I think, probably is the best way to describe it.
Because I was wondering, would it have been your job, part of your job, to think of the sponsors you could get, or would they be suggested to you and then you sort of went after them? How would that work?
There's a difference. You've got acquisition, business development, which is Ekram Sami. Did you know me, Ekram?
Yes, no, I didn't, but I know the name, obviously.
And then there was customer services. So I did the special projects, but when Richard West used to do was the marketing manager before, and then he went to William. And but we started to do more different things like the hospitality and various others.
So let's go back to Tag Heuer then.
Well, the involvement with Tag Heuer came first. They first appeared on the car back in 1986, I think it was, as a Wash Fair. But the reason for that, all that was, is that Tag, Technique d'Avant-Garde, which actually owned 60% of McLaren, I think, if I got the figures right, Mansur Auger, they just bought Heuer. Then they wanted to do. Basically, they had a huge supply of different watch models, whatever. It was everything they liked. They put in, and there was a whole episode went of streamlining the product range. Now they brought in a company called Booz Allen, who are a management consultant, to work on it. And to come up with some recommendations. And there's a guy called Christian Viros who was the guy that led it. And then the one guy that concentrated on America, the North American market, and then another one that did Far East and whatever. And they come out with this plan. And we went to a number of different meetings, and I basically asked what I actually did. I was basically I'd handled all the paperwork. I was the liaison from Protagoi and McLaren as such through Ron, through Mansur. We've got to get involved, and then we were working with the advertising agencies, was Bartleberg Hegarty, and also putting on the display how the watches were actually displayed as such. So they did use the, and I remember the used the offices in TAG, which was in Paris, you know, big gold tables in the boardroom and whatever. I mean, very sumptuous, very tastefully done. And they presented the Booz Allen guys presented their proposal to Ron and Mansur and with Jack Rosser, who was the finance director. And so Ron said, "Yeah, do you believe what you've just presented?" They looked at him and think, "What's he on about? What do you mean? Do you really think you can make it work?" "Yes, of course." We blah, 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 blah. So this went on for a bit, and he said, "Okay, got a deal for you. Why don't we employ you to implement the plan?" You know, that matter that must strike terror in every management consultant because then they think, "Oh God, we've recommended it. We've got to deliver on it." And that's how it became. And then they went in and they rationaled. And there were effectively three types of watches. There was the plastic Formula One watch, which was the team went. They kept the 2000, which is like the one I've got on, which was actually given to me by Christian Viros 20 years ago, no, 1990. And then there was the Sell, which was the high end. So I'm trying to remember what the cell name meant, but it was doing it. And then linked to that were various sports promotions as well. So they had Mansur and TAG had the a trimaran, which they had the guy a skipper called Mike Birch, who and they had a something like a I think it was a 24-hour record, or they used to sail it for across from St. Malo to one of the islands in the West Indies. Yeah, we had this. I remember I had to take drive down to St. Malo with lots of bits and pieces and to give them to the skipper, Mike Birch. And then they set off sail and they were sailing along, and TAG brought their helicopter. And now this, you know, these weren't just normal pilots, these were a sort of ex-military and all sorts of things. And I remember being in this helicopter with Jacques Rosset, who was the finance director, and he positioned the TAG boat was sailing along, so they positioned the helicopter at an angle to sort of give more wind going into the sails of the draft.
Brilliant.
They did that, and they did skiing, and we put together a ski proposal. There was a guy who was the manager of Gerhard, a guy called Burkhard Hummel, who was ran the and Hartie Vaarrater was one of the skiers. So they had Hartie and here can't remember the names now. And Marc Giardelli was one of the Italian stars, and we did the downhill season. So in fact, I have the distinction of being put on a set of skis and trying to be taught by Annie Wenzel. There was a lady skier, and she gave up. She says, "There's no way I could ever teach you to ski because you're no good." So yeah, so I ran the TAG ski promotion as well. So we did again. We do the events, and then did hospitality for them and an incentive activity. But it was fun. We had all sorts of daft things we actually did. It was good. So
Excellent.
that led on to one of the things we'd learned, especially with Sea Goddess, was about giving hospitality. Because what had happened is that it used to go to the Paddock Club, was in its emerging state with Paddy McNally's operation. And they did a good job, but McLaren being McLaren decided they had to do something better. So they built a purpose-built interior. So these tents, we had the standard tents, but we increased the size of the tents for the number of people. So instead of having 1 square meter per person, they had 3 square meters. That was the calculation. And we did this hospitality, which we launched in Germany in 89, I think, and that built up. So we were, it became a show as such. It's all about the philosophy is that the more you explain, the more you give information, the more hooked you get. And I was brought in as well to be the host as such. So I would do the talking bit. So you're building them up. So the Friday you do the speeches and you're doing that to the lower management. On Saturday you do it to the senior management, and then to the VIPs you do it on a Sunday. So you do the presentation explaining what Formula One's about it. And one of the ways of doing it was to, the male-female psyche, that, you realise the difference between men and women, and the fact is that you could give them a problem, they'd solve it a different way, but they'd actually come to the same conclusion. But what we also found was that if you explain to the ladies in detail, you're not doing a disservice. You're explaining it in a better way. And the men were always used to get more interested in the gearbox and how many widgets you got and all that sort of boring stuff, quite frankly. You drag them along, and you're tying to the ladies. Who, what we'd found is that majority will become very interested in it, providing you explained. You know, it's all about being relative. So then you'd say, "What's it like to sit in a Formula One car?" And I said, "Well, very few people ever have the chance to do it. But if you've got a bath in your bathroom, lie in the bath and put your feet on the taps, and you get an idea of what driving position you'll be in." Or in the days of refueling, when they came in and refueled, they're probably putting the equivalent weight of a driver in behind. And, what was the other one? 260 kilometres an hour. Mathematically, you had enough downforce to drive the car upside down. We never found a driver silly enough to do it, or a tunnel long enough. But we did actually have the company's magazine, Racing Line. We actually did it as an April Fool's joke, and which a lot of people believed.
Excellent.
So we developed the hospitality, and it became like a worldwide business. We were turning over $6-8 million dollars a year. It was designed to wash its face, but it was a sponsorship retention muscle. And the way we used to describe it, you have a sponsor, and you put your arms around them, and you give them a big, big cuddle, and what you're actually doing is tightening the grip on them, so they can't escape. They feel secure, and that's really the secret of the longevity of it's the work that goes in. It's not just getting the sponsor, which a lot of people can do. It's keeping them running and excited. So you've always got to be doing something new.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So the hospitality was born and bred, and then we did similar things at different circuits. Certainly, the American Grand Prix was one where we knew a lot of the sponsors were going to want to have the drivers there, and the demand was far in excess of what supply was. So we did it the other way around. We found this venue called the Arts Garden, which is like a big conservatory, but it's positioned over the two of the main artery roads in downtown Indianapolis. And we put on a show, which consisted of using both drivers, and I did the interviews with them, and you'd explain the bigger background. Because how do you explain what a Formula One is compared to an Indy car? Well, they both have wings, they both have slicks, they both go fast. And in fact, an Indy car goes a damn sight faster than a Formula One car because of the way that it's built and all that sort of thing. So we get around, we talk about the technical side as such. And we did it 2 years. The first year, we joined forces. Ron and Mansour had particularly become friends with Guy de Liberty, who was the guy behind Cirque du Soleil, and a number of things. And so we did four acts with the Cirque du Soleil. So when I say acts, you're saying, right, you're explaining precision, teamwork, and various other things, and use those as an example. So the finesse of Formula One, and then the following year we did it with Penn and Teller, the magicians as such, who were really good. That particular year was fraught because it was about a week after September the 11th, so the big crowds that we were going to have suddenly diminished to a fraction, and then all of them came by, they drove as opposed to going by flights. But I remember coming through because when we got on the plane at British Airways plane in London, the strict security, etc. You get off the plane, you go into Indianapolis, and if the color of your skin was a certain way, you went through, no. And then the got some of the security people were earning less than they were in McDonald's. So that's a part of the background as to why it sort of changed. But I learned one lesson very, very, very cute, very poignantly, when I trusted Cirque du Soleil that year. They're the professional guys; they know to get about the microphones. But it didn't quite work that way. So, well, the sound was not very good for when Ron was up on the stage, and you guess who got the blame for that. So,
Yeah, you do, of course.
the following year, I learned my lesson, and I will personally go through and sound check. And as the sound check changes whether depending on how many people are in the room. So of course, if you've got more people, the sound becomes deafened. We got it right, and I remember there were the big wigs of Mercedes were there or whatever, and they were, "Oh, Peter, you've done a great job, thank you." And it came to Ron, and this is the biggest words of encouragement I think I ever had. He was like, "You know what? We've had 2 days and no F ups. Well done." That was high praise to come from
That
our research.
it wasn't well
But
done, PD. It's a good job, and it's all gone off okay. It's just,
yeah, exactly. So that was it. But then on top of that, then I started 89. I think this is if you hear, we can stop because I think the rubbish bin is outside making noise. That's 89. I started going to the Grand Prix on a more regular basis, and then for the next 17, I did. I was with McLaren for 17 years, and I think that was 15 years of that, 13 years of that I was traveling. I used to do it. I don't know if you know Crichton, remember Crichton Brown, who was one of the main directors. I learned from Crichton, who was a real gentleman. Just thinking how Formula One has changed. We used to have a little bit of spare time, not a lot, but at least you go to exotic countries and you see the airport and you see the hotel and you see the track, and that's it. And say, "I've been to South Africa and I've seen the roads going to and from the track and to and from the airport." Where was I? Oh yes, the 89. Gordon Murray was on board at that stage, and there was Gordon, Crichton, and myself, and we took a hire car or a chauffeur-driven car in Mexico, and to go to the pyramids. And they have the pyramids, and then you walk progressively. You walk to the very top of it, and I think this is a pretty amazing experience. And then you get there. There's the guy selling merchandise and tap right at the very top. But it is just some of the different things that we used to be able to do. And one of the things the lead was because there was myself. I again had we didn't have a press officer. We used the press officer for Honda to do a lot of the work. I was the one that how you deal with the drivers. Richard West before had had the matey way of doing it, and he could do it with Alain Prost because, "Come on, me old mate, you're not going to be when you finish your golf, you're going to come and do this." I was the one that I was with Ayrton, so I was introduced to Ayrton. And well, the first thing that I really noticed about Ayrton was his handshake. Now you have Gerhard who will take your hand and he crush it. Ayrton's was actually quite a limp handshake, very, very soft. And I think there was a two contrast to the man. There was the ultra aggressive guy who was on the track who'd be absolutely and utterly ruthless. But coupled to that, off the track, there was actually a very kind, generous man. And the more you got to know him, the more it is. Not to say he didn't let me down a number of times about different promotions and things he shouldn't do. But you used to sit down and say, "Okay, Ayrton, this is the schedule. This is what you've got to do, whatever." And you had to make sure that it was right, it's correct, it was going to work, and it was to the nothing was going to go and get in its way because, if you did, you'd be in trouble. You'd still get the words, "Peter, I know I should do it, but I'm not. You can tell Ron I'm not going to do this." And it happened a few times. Hungary in, I can't remember the year, Hungary in 92, I think, and Ayrton was looking for Prost's seat at Williams. Was an hour and a half late getting to the Marlborough function, and you can imagine, who's in the firing line? Me. Where is he? Where is he? And he's coming, don't panic. Have another glass of champagne. He was an hour and a half late, and we had to bundle him out of the hotel to get to the venue or whatever. And he was flustered, and of course it didn't go down well with the high price help in Marlborough. But actually, when he looked back, the reason he was in Frank Williams's room negotiating the contract. Yeah, load of those things. And then he had in '93. It was $1 million a race, so he didn't get on the plane. The money in place, which is progressive. But again, it shows what a ruthless. Formula One. These guys aren't pussycats. They are all of them are totally utterly ruthless. But there's the softer side. In '89, we were at the Phoenix Grand Prix. Now we got used to numbers, a large number of people going to race. Well, I think there was about 30,000. That was about it. I mean, the joke used to be going to Jerez, and every time you went in, said good morning to the spectator because there was no one else. Yeah. But the softer side of him, we were going to a function or two Marlborough functions at either end. We stayed in this lovely hotel called the Phoenician Resort, which was in Scottsdale, which is like the Beverly Hills of Phoenix as such. And because they had two kilometers or so of land on the Scottsdale, the rest was somewhere else. They could have themselves with that primary address. And I was walking, I took him to one function, and I was walking back through the corridors with him. And you got to know him reasonably well that. And he came. There was a fan, because actually in America there are lots of fans, but Formula One was quite a niche sport, so you had to be really in. He got this lady, and she just stood there with her eyes wide open, sort of jaw dropped, waiting, couldn't to meet, to actually meet him or whatever. And she was gaga, absolutely gaga, but he was kind. He took his autograph and did that. Similarly, a few years later, when we won the championship in 91 or 90, someone had the bright idea that it'd be a good idea after you won the championship to go and take him to the Honda tent. Well, there was this little larmy of us marketing chaps that surrounded him and gradually ushered him out to the Honda tent. And every once in a while, we'd stop, and then there'd be a little girl who'd fallen over in the group. And she stopped, and he picked her up or whatever, and she smiled, took out a camera, took a photograph, and then disappeared. But it was that calm side. There's quite a few VIPs. Michael Douglas was always very impressive because He put his jacket and he'd stop and he'd put his jacket and straight and take the photographs. And then apparently he was escorting the Joe Ramirez back to the helipad in Monza, I think it was. And he was waving to the crowd. And Joe said, "Hey, Michael, they're not for you. They're doing it for me."
What did he say? Anything? Yeah, okay.
And he smiled. He smiled. And the other one was Mr. Bean, or Rowan Atkinson. And he was sitting in his chair because he's a professional. And he'd tell me, meet him and say, "Hello, my name's Rowan Atkinson." But he's sitting there and he wanted to scratch his ear. And it was one of these. How do you imagine Mr. Bean would do it?
Excellent. Yeah, good.
God, all these stories are coming back to me now. Where do we get to?
Right, so we've done the pyramids in Mexico. Now I've got something that says Ron Dennis bet and food. What was that?
Ah, yes. It was in Mexico Grand Prix, and in those days the clientele was small enough that you went along to the dinners. So there were the two drivers when they were talking to each other. That's before they could hit the fan. And the drivers were always taking the mickey out of Ron and vice versa. And he got to the point where Ron was bet $1,000 that he wouldn't eat the bowl of chilies.
Oh, okay. Right.
So he never wanted to not take a bet up. Ron duly did. He went very quiet for a period of time and drank a lot of water, and his face colour changed a little bit. But he actually sat down, and I thought, Christ, I'd have done it for 500.
Yeah. Oh, dear. And he won.
Yeah, he won. And then that, because that's it, we were in Phoenix, and then they were guessing, I think it was his 40th birthday. And they had the ZZ Top, and they were the beards, so sort of. So imagine on your T-shirt, you've got Graham Hill, it's the beards go down to about that sort of level. And quite astounding. But I have to say, the work for Ron in those days, it was one of the best apprenticeships you could ever have, because if you got into a sticky problem, you'd turn around and say, "Now, what would Ron have done in these circumstances?" And
Even now.
even now, look at the his farewell, because it was all right. He's only a chapter in the book of McLaren. Now, hiring the Albert Hall for a circus, we took the we I was not working for McLaren then. They took over the whole 3,000 seats for company employees or whatever, and that shows the mental of the man. He was a leader. He could, he could be ruthless. He could be a pain in the ass sometimes. But he used to, he always had to have his say about attention to detail. So in the hospitality, he always used to leave a couple of chairs or tables and chairs in the wrong place. So he found them. So he didn't even find what anything else had been left around.
Or put some knives and forks around the wrong way, that sort
Yeah, you just had to leave something so he could, he was happy to go and fault in something.